This is David Crowe. Welcome to episode 222 of my radio show, The Infectious Myth. Today, I have two guests, part of the resistance to the refluoridation of the water in Calgary. As you will tell from the discussion, Calgary has played an important role in the history of water fluoridation. It also happens to be the city that I live in. For context, if Calgary was an American city, it would be the sixth largest, being slightly larger in population than Philadelphia. My first guest is Dr. Paul Connett, a graduate of Cambridge with a PhD in chemistry from Dartmouth College. From 1983 to 2006, Paul taught chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, where he specialized in environmental chemistry and toxicology. His 32 years of research on waste management have taken him all over the world, where he's given over 2,500 pro bono public presentations. In 1996, he started to investigate water fluoridation. In 2000, he helped found the Fluoride Action Network, which he directed from 2000 to 2015. In 2003, he was invited to present to a panel appointed by the U.S. National Research Council, which published a landmark review of fluoride toxicity in 2006. In 2010, with two other authors, James Beck, MD, PhD, who's also from Calgary, and Spedding Micklem, he published The Case Against Fluoride. Currently, Paul is the senior advisor to the Fluoride Action Network and specializes in international liaison among groups in other fluoridating countries. The second guest is Dr. Bob Dixon, a Calgary-based family physician who's fought water fluoridation in the city since the end of the 1990s, when he changed his mind, and who recently founded Safe Water Calgary to make sure that the city remains unfluoridated. Let's go to the interview. Welcome to the show, Paul and Bob. Thank you very much for coming to join me today to talk about water fluoridation. Paul, is fluoride found in any natural biological systems?
Not really, no. I think you can find it in shark's teeth. But basically, nature recognized early that fluoride was very toxic. It was incompatible with most of biology. And so nature's devised defense mechanisms for the lower creatures like bacteria, fungi, and so on, proteins which export fluoride out of the tissue. And of course, when you get to mammals, we have kidneys which get rid of about 50% of the fluoride from the bloodstream. And then the rest is sequestered in the hard tissues, in the bone in particular.
So sequestered, it's kept there permanently?
Yep.
Out of circulation.
Well, the bone turns over, but in our case, if you're drinking fluoridated water, you're getting a steady increase in fluoride concentration in the bone. It bioaccumulates.
Right.
So over a lifetime, the fluoride is getting more and more concentrated.
In the bones. Fluoride is used in some industrial processes, and what are those, and has this been associated with any health problems?
Yes, fluoride used in particular in the aluminum industry, in the smelting of aluminum. Fluoride is a very major component, and the aluminum industry has been responsible for a huge amount of pollution, which has damaged vegetation, crippled cattle, subject of many, many lawsuits before fluoridation began in the 1940s.
Was fluoride also used in the nuclear bomb development?
Yep, fluoride to separate the isotopes of uranium. You make uranium hexafluoride, and that allows you to separate it by different diffusion rates. So yes, a huge amount of fluoride was used in making the atomic bomb.
And what were the health problems associated with the people or animals that were in the vicinity of these aluminum or nuclear bomb factories?
In particular, the cattle grazing on the grass, which was receiving both the toxic gases and the particulate, would be crippled. The cattle got dental fluorosis and lost their teeth. And therefore, you can see videos today of cows drinking water and lapping it like a dog because it was so painful to the stumps of their teeth to drink the water. And also crippled. You can also see videotapes of cows on their haunches because their bones have been completely crippled.
So as a chemist, what started you thinking that water fluoridation to reduce cavities was not a good idea?
I was approached three times in the 1990s to look into this issue, and I kept them away because I was teaching full-time chemistry as a professor of chemistry, and I was active around the world fighting incinerators, promoting better ways of handling waste. and it's taken me now to 66 different countries. So I didn't want a third issue to occupy my time, and I didn't want an issue that would stigmatize me as Looney Tunes, which is the way that they handle opponents of fluoridation. Or worse, they fire them. What got me involved was my wife. She insisted that I read the literature because the village was discussing ending fluoridation. She wanted to know what to tell them. I thought when I read that literature, I wanted to get rid of her as quickly as possible to get this out of my life. So I was
get rid of this issue. No,
get rid of the both. Yes. To get rid of the issue. So I was looking for ways that the critics were wrong. And the first thing I thought is that they were confusing fluorine gas with fluoride, the salt compound of fluoride. Mm. Very different entities, but they hadn't made that confusion. What I did find out was very, very disturbing, that the level of fluoride in mother's milk was extremely low. And that didn't make sense to me. If fluoride was necessary for the development of a baby, that's where it would be. Mm-hmm. So basically, who do you believe, the dentist in Chicago, or do you believe Mother Nature as what the baby needs in its first meal? I decided that nature knew best, that the dentists were wrong. And after that, the chemistry clicked in, and you could see why nature kept fluoride away from the baby. Because it interferes with hydrogen bonds. It complexes with all the metals that you need in your body. Not all of them, but most of them. It inhibits enzymes. The first people to oppose fluoridation in the United States were biochemists. Biochemists in Wisconsin. You had these crazy dentists pushing fluoridation in the 1950s, and they were going around saying, "Don't do it! Fluoride poisons enzymes. You need enzymes to be healthy." And one of them was James Sumner. He won the Nobel Prize in enzyme chemistry, and he said, "You just don't do it. You poison enzymes. You're going to kill people. Or you're going to make them sick."
There was research that was used to promote the idea in the 40s or 50s that water fluoridation reduced cavities. Yeah. So what were the problems with that research? So one thing to say that fluoride's a poison, but did the research show that it was successful at reducing cavities?
There are so many factors which influence tooth decay, and whether or not that fluoride was the key issue. And how did they control, for example, did the early researchers control for the different levels of calcium, magnesium in the water, hard versus soft water? Did they control carefully for income levels, for race, for diet? There's so many factors. But if you look at the history, the real issue in the early part of the 20th century is what causes dental mottling, this discoloration of the enamel. And in 1931, they came back with the answer. It was fluoride. So they changed the name from dental mottling to dental fluorosis. Mm-hmm. But the dentists that were doing this, they thought that the kids that had this marking, this horrible marking of the teeth, had less tooth decay. And that was the origin. Maybe there's a level at which we can lower tooth decay without causing too much dental fluorosis. Mm-hmm. And they settled on one part per million. But half of that equation, David, is no longer valid, because we now have over 40% of children in their teens in the United States with dental fluorosis. So they may or may not have lowered tooth decay, probably with fluoridated toothpaste, not with fluoridated water. But whether they have or not, the one thing that they haven't done is to minimize dental fluorosis. They've actually maximized dental fluorosis.
Is dental fluorosis more than a cosmetic issue?
Yes, it is. It is. It's an indicator that you've poisoned the child. It's an indicator that you've interfered with biochemistry, the biochemistry of the proteins which are involved in laying down this healthy enamel. You've interfered with that. Well, if you interfere with those proteins, if you interfere with enzymes, you're going to interfere with other tissues. We can see dental fluorosis, but we cannot see with the naked eye those other tissues that might have been impacted. Unfortunately, once the US Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation in 1950, any serious research into other health effects went by the board. It was all promotion. Once the US Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation, all the professional bodies dental associations, medical associations, public health associations, all fell in line, followed the mantra, it's safe and effective, safe and effective. And they weren't out to find research, to do research, to show there was a problem. We're now doing it, and we're finding the problems, but 70 years too late.
Is the water fluoridated in most other advanced economies outside North America, like the United Kingdom, France, Japan, etc.?
Now, this is the serious joke, because most people in America walking around, and Canada for that matter, thinking that everybody in the civilized world is fluoridating their water. Absolutely untrue. Only 5% of the world's population is drinking fluoridated water. Most of them live in North America. 97% of Europe does not fluoridate its water. But guess what? If you look at World Health Organization data, their tooth decay is as good, the quality of their teeth is as good, if not better, than ours. So most of the world does not do this. Most of the world does not force medication on people without their informed consent. And most of the world recognizes that the research is lousy. They have done not done enough research, that the health issues have not been resolved to the point that a government can force it on its people.
Well, let's talk about that, the actual administration of fluoride, because there's a very specific concentration of fluoride in the water when you drink it, but how can you control the individual dosage?
That's the biggest question, and that's a question which the other side, the promoters of fluoridation, they obfuscate this all the time. They intimate if you control the concentration, everything is hunky-dory. So in Canada, it's 0.8 parts per million, okay, or 0.7. Do we want 0.7 or 0.8? Nonsense. It depends on how much water you drink. Somebody drinking 2 liters of water is going to get twice the dose of somebody who drinks 1 liter. And then you've got to consider other sources of fluoride. Concentration is measured in milligrams per liter. Mm-hmm. Dose is measured in milligrams per day, which depends on how many liters of water you drink. And what we're concerned about is total dose, which is the milligrams you get from water, the milligrams per day you get from toothpaste, from pesticides, from air pollution, and so on. So just rabbiting on about how much the level of concentration is in the water and how your engineers can control that is an absolute diversionary tactic from the real issue. And it's even worse than that, David, because it isn't just dose. It depends upon your body weight. I think everybody knows that an aspirin, the dose of an aspirin is much lower for a child than from an adult, because it depends upon the size of the creature, the size of the human being. So for a toxic substance like fluoride, it's worse for a child than an adult. It's worse for a baby than a child. And now, heaven forbid, it's worse for the fetus than the child. Mm-hmm. And no regulatory agency in the world has ever considered the impacts of fluoride on the fetus when determining safe levels. Not one. The World Health Organization, no health agency has considered that, and it's a fatal flaw in especially when you're exposing the whole population to this substance in every glass of water, every cup of tea, every cup of coffee, every meal that they eat in Calgary. Once upon a time in Calgary, I'm in Calgary when we're talking, but elsewhere.
Yeah, we'll talk about the situation in Calgary, which is where we are right now, and why you're in Calgary in a little bit. So what is the generally accepted level of toxicity of fluoride? Like, at what level in the water would they say there's too much fluoride in North America?
You're talking to a scientist now, and I say quite categorically that fluoride is following the safe trajectory, the same trajectory as lead. The level of lead, which is deemed safe for a child, is a function of how good your experiments are, how sensitive your experiments are. The better our experiments, the better our research is, the lower and lower a level of fluoride which will be acceptable. I would stake my life on the fact that the closest to an acceptable level is the level in mother's milk, which is 0.004 parts per million. So the issue is not going to be whether we deliberately add fluoride to the water. The issue is going to be how many communities are going to have to spend a lot of money removing natural fluoride. Just as we do with arsenic. There is no safe level for arsenic. And so the issue is how much money can you spend in your community to get arsenic levels down as low as practically possible and economically feasible.
I believe that in the water, that the concentration is somewhere around 1 part per million to 0.7 part per million in different places.
Well, that's what we add.
That's the
recommended level. The actual average level of fluoride in water, most water supplies, is 0.1 parts per million. We're adding about 10 times the so-called natural levels. And when we use the word natural, we shouldn't confuse biology with geology. Mm-hmm. What is natural we're talking about is the vagaries of which rocks the water has flowed through. And nature has nothing to do with that. The rocks came first, biology came second. And what level nature feels is safe, I think the best indicator is mother's milk.
Right, but I just wanted to get the numbers.
Yeah.
You said 0.004.
In mother's milk is 0.004.
Versus 1 part per million
exactly.
In fluoridated water. That's a massive difference.
Or in Calgary, 0.2 to 0.3 in the Bow system and the Elbow system, respectively.
Yeah. So when you bottle feed a baby and you use fluoridated tap water to make up formula, you're giving your baby about 200 times more fluoride than nature intended. Mm-hmm. You're removing nature's protection. It's reckless, absolutely reckless.
There are countries around the world where the concentration of fluoride is so high that it's a problem.
Oh, yeah.
So can you name some of those countries and what are some of the problems that people experience?
Good question. No, the countries, the ones that come to mind, obviously, are India and China, where literally millions of people have had their bones wrecked by fluoride. They have what we call endemic areas for fluorosis. When you visit those countries, you find the children have dental fluorosis, which is now what we're getting, a plague of it in the United States and possibly Canada. And then when you see the adults in the same villages, they are crippled. They have skeletal fluorosis.
So hunched over because their bones are
collapsing. Their backbone becomes a solid piece. They can't bend it. Yeah, it's desperately sad, and those countries are doing their best to get fluoride out of the water with various removal systems, and they are producing honest science, because India and China are interested in finding what level of fluoride do they need to get down to protect citizens. We, on the other hand, are adding fluoride, which they find a particularly extraordinary thing to do.
Right, because, I mean, I'm not sure if everybody realizes this, but you can never eliminate any substance totally.
No.
And the more you want to eliminate it, there's, you know, the cost goes up
absolutely.
Exponentially, right?
No, you're right. Absolutely right.
And so if you have a very high level of fluoride, you're saying, okay, it's going to cost us this much to get to this level. Yeah. To get to this level is more. Is it worth it?
You know,
how low do we go?
Well, that's right. Well, in China, of course, they use things like bone char, which is relatively cheap to remove the fluoride. In many cases, in Chinese villages, it's a question of where you put the well. A lot of villages have this skeletal fluorosis because they've got very shallow wells. Mm. And once they go below a certain depth, then they've solved the problem.
Oh, okay. So there's other solutions.
Yeah.
You've talked about emerging evidence of health effects at the standard dose for water fluoridation of, you know, 1 part per million or a little bit below.
Yeah.
So what's some of the solid evidence on health effects at those levels?
Okay, well, for about 20-odd years, we've been getting a growing number of studies from India and China, some from Iran and some from Mexico, where they've had the high natural levels. And in their studies, to find what would be a safe level, they have found a lowering of IQ. They found if they compared children in a high fluoride village with children in a low fluoride village, the children in the high fluoride village have lower IQ. And the consistency of these studies is remarkable. For instance, there was a review done by Harvard in 2012. They looked at 27 communities, 25 in China, two in Iran, 27 studies. 26 of them showed a lower IQ in the high fluoride villages. Very consistent. Now, people have looked at these studies and said, they're weaknesses, you haven't given us all the information, the levels are much higher than we have here, blah, blah, blah. But the consistency cannot be denied, even though out of these 27 studies, they were covered 22 years, done by different research teams, different countries, different geographical areas. Only one of the studies did not show a statistically significant difference in IQ. So that's the basis, if you like, a growing body of evidence, along with animal studies, which showed very supporting evidence, like animals put into mazes are less able to learn, remember where the cheese is, blah, blah, blah. Very consistent. Then, in September of 2017, came the bombshell. A 12-year study, multi-million-dollar study, financed by the US government agencies like the NIH, EPA, both of which either promote or defend fluoridation, and importantly, the NIEHS, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which I believe is one of the most honest and the best scientific regulatory bodies in the United States. And not a regulatory body, actually, they just do the science. And in their house organ, Environmental Health Perspectives, there was this study. And this study was a bombshell. They found a very strong relationship between the exposure of pregnant women as measured by fluoride levels in their urine exposure. And the urine level is important that they use that biometric, because the level in the urine reflects any source of fluoride.
Whether yeah, you so get toothpaste, the
any,
water.
Any source.
If you buy bottled water that has fluoride in it or not, it's all...
All that. So here you add up the total, it's going to show up in the urine. Strong relationship between that urine level and the IQ of their children at 4 years of age, and then again at between 6 and 12. And for the range of fluoride levels in the United States amongst pregnant women, we're looking at a 5 to 6 fold different, a 5 to 6 IQ point drop. So if you look at women pregnant, urine levels of the highest levels versus the lowest levels in the United States, you're seeing an IQ difference of 5 to 6 IQ points. Now, the first reaction of the promoters of fluoridation is, oh, well, this is Mexico City, you've got other sources of they don't fluoridate their water. Irrelevant. They measured the fluoride levels in the urine. Doesn't matter what the source was. Then they said, oh, well, you've got pollution levels. Okay. Now they've done a study in Canada. And in Canada, they looked at the fluoride levels in pregnant women in Canada. And they found, first of all, that the level of fluoride in the urine of pregnant women in fluoridated communities in Canada is about twice the level of the fluoride levels in the urine of non-fluoridated communities. So in other words, water is a big source of fluoride.
Right.
Number two, they found that the average level in the fluoridated communities, the pregnant women in fluoridated communities, was almost identical to this Mexico City study. It was 0.87 in Canada, it was 0.91 in Mexico City. That is virtually no difference.
So we should be able to extrapolate from that that similar reductions in IQ would be found in fluoridated communities.
Absolutely. This team was highly experienced. You had researchers from Toronto, McGill, Mount Sinai, Harvard, Michigan, Indiana, Institute in Mexico City itself, highly qualified. Between them, they put out 50 papers on similar techniques with different neurotoxicants, and they controlled for every variable under the sun. And they took into account all the criticisms made of the Chinese and the Indian studies. So this is a pretty iron-cast study. It's pretty secure. And we have reason to believe that there's a study in the pipeline which will duplicate this Mexico City study.
You also mentioned thyroid problems.
Yes.
So how do those arise, and what is the significance of the thyroid, say, to a fetus or to a young child?
Okay, well, let me just give you a little bit of history here. Long before fluoridation began, in the 40s and 50s, doctors in Argentina, France, and Germany were giving patients who had overactive thyroid, hyperthyroid, they were giving them fluoride to lower their thyroid activity. And the people that introduced fluoridation should have looked at those studies and said, "Why? Wait a moment, if you lower the activity of hyperthyroid people with fluoride, what are you going to do with people with normal thyroid or people who are low? Aren't you going to make it worse?" Never asked that question. But anyway, what this researcher, Ashley Malin, from Canada, Canada, she's now with Mount Sinai, what Ashley Malin found was that when she looked at thyroid function as measured by TSH levels, the lower your thyroid function, the higher the level of TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. So as your thyroid function goes down, the level of this TSH goes up. And what she found, no difference, this was a surprise to me, but she found no difference in the TSH levels on average between women in fluoridated communities versus non-fluoridated communities in Canada. But what she found was if the woman had borderline iodine deficiency or even outright iodine deficiency, a little bit of fluoride made it worse. So the TSH levels went up with fluoride exposure. And the levels we're talking about, that with exposure to fluoridated water, the thyroid function got worse for this particular subset. And I think, Bob, you can tell us what percentage of Canadians have borderline iodine deficiency.
It's about 18 to 19% of Canadians have iodine deficiency.
So we're talking here about a subset of people who are extra sensitive to the effect of fluoride. And of course, if it's in the drinking water, it comes out of everybody's tap.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. When a fetus comes into existence, it has no thyroid gland. So its mental development is regulated, like all its development, is regulated by the thyroid hormones. And so it's totally dependent upon the mother's thyroid status. It's using the thyroid hormones from the pregnant mum to do its mental development. And we've known for a very long time that a woman whose thyroid function is compromised will produce children with lower IQ. So we probably have the mechanism of why in Mexico City there's a strong relationship between exposure to fluoride and lowered IQ. It's affecting the thyroid function of the pregnant woman.
Okay, so in summary, a woman who is more susceptible because of lower iodine levels or... will then have lower thyroid function, which will affect the brain development of her fetus.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Are there other conditions that make people more sensitive to fluoride or make it more likely to have some kind of toxicity from fluoride?
Absolutely. If you've got poor kidney function, then you can't do that 50% elimination. So you, and this is true of everybody, as you get older, your kidney functions tend to get weaker. But there are people with kidney conditions, and this is one of the reasons that the National Kidney Foundation in the United States has withdrawn its support for fluoridation, is this susceptibility. Then you've got certain diseases in which you drink a lot of water. So, for example, there are forms of diabetes where people drink excessive amounts of water. Those people are going to get more fluoride. One of the reasons you don't medicate everybody through the drinking water, and don't forget, we've only done this with fluoride. There's no other substance, vitamin or drug, that we've ever deliberately added to the drinking water, even though some doctors advocate lithium and statins be put into the drinking water. Fortunately, they've been laughed out of court. The only one we've done it with is fluoride. And the reason that you don't do this is because the response of a human being to any toxic substance, it follows the bell-shaped curve, the normal distribution, which means that most people have an average response. But at the two tails, you've got a small fraction of the population that is super sensitive to right. that toxic substance, and at the other tail, super resistance to that toxic substance. It is absolutely scientifically inevitable. If you put a toxic substance in the drinking water, regardless of level, you will hurt some people. Mm-hmm. And these are the people that cry out, I'm sensitive to fluoride. And those people have been ignored by every government that fluoridates.
So Bob, what happened while the city of Calgary was fluoridating to people who were sensitive? Did they do anything?
They weren't heard.
So if you had kidney problems, you would have to buy bottled water, which didn't have fluoride in it.
Or buy a reverse osmosis system, which mm-hmm. costs hundreds of dollars to put it under your sink in your kitchen, or it costs thousands of dollars to put a whole house reverse osmosis system in. Virtually no systems remove fluoride except for reverse osmosis and distillation.
And the city gave no support to those people. There were no subsidies.
Those people were absolutely ignored. They weren't heard, they weren't helped, they weren't assisted. There was nothing for them.
There were some other health effects that we talked about before we got started. In older people, arthritis and bone disorders are probably bigger concerns than what might happen to a fetus if you're 50 yeah. or 60 or 70.
Well, there's several issues with the bone. And as I mentioned earlier, the bone does concentrate the fluoride. It's the first, after the kidney, it's your first level of protection. It's the bone sequesters the fluoride. The first symptoms of fluoride poisoning, as identified in India and China in the 1940s, was pains in the joints, stiffness in the joints. These are exactly the same symptoms that you get with arthritis. Mm-hmm. So whilst we got an epidemic of arthritis in places like Canada, and the authorities have never sought to do research to see if there was a relationship between arthritis rates and the amount of fluoride that people have been exposed to. An obvious thing to do, they've never done it. There's a very well-known relationship between dental fluorosis and how much fluoride you're exposed to. That is quantitative. The more right. fluoride a child is exposed to before the permanent teeth have erupted, the more severe the dental fluorosis. So in Canada, you've got literally thousands of children with no dental fluorosis, thousands with very mild dental fluorosis, thousands with mild dental fluorosis, thousands with moderate dental fluorosis, and some with severe dental fluorosis. You've got the ideal biometric to assess all kinds of childhood complaints and ailments and, mm-hmm. and changes by looking at the severity of dental fluorosis versus whatever you're concerned about, whether it's onset of puberty, whether it's bone fractures in children, whether it's IQ and so on. You've got the biometric. It's only been used once in the United States. It was used in Mexico when they found a very strong relationship in Mexico between bone fractures in children and dental fluorosis. The more severe the dental fluorosis, the higher the frequency of bone fractures in the village.
Where does the fluoride that goes into the water system come from?
It's not pharmaceutical grade fluoride. It's actually taken from the scrubbing systems of the phosphate fertilizer industry. For about 100 years, the fumes, the phosphate industry, they take phosphate rock and they treat it with sulfuric acid to get soluble phosphate mm-hmm. for fertilizers. The result of that is the production of two very toxic gases, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. And for 100 years, they were decimating cattle, just like the fluoride emissions from aluminum smelters, and damaging the citrus groves in Florida and so on. After about 100 years of this, we're slow learners, they put on a scrubbing system, which is just a spray of water. And that water converts these fluorine, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride to hexafluorosilicic acid. And when that accumulates in the scrubbing systems to about 23%, that untreated is sent by trucks to public water supplies to use as a fluoridating chemical. Now, the irony of this is you can't dump that into the sea by international law. It's far too concentrated to dump into local streams and lakes. You've got to have a huge water supply to dilute this stuff down, 186,000 to one. Where have you got a huge water supply? Answer, you've got, the public water works. We could put it in our water. I mean, it's so preposterous. And the way this is covered in law in the United States is as follows. The EPA's hazardous waste regulations encourage industry to recycle its toxic products. And that's sensible, you know. You want to keep those toxic chemicals within industry. And what the thing is, once you sell a toxic waste, it becomes a product. Mm-hmm. And once it's a product, it's no longer controlled as hazardous waste. And this is the flimsy basis on which the Public Water Works can put toxic waste into our drinking water, along with the connivance of the FDA, the CDC, and the EPA, all turning a blind eye to this convenient way of getting rid of a massive amount of hazardous waste.
Very convenient. Both of you are obviously convinced that water fluoridation is a bad idea. That's no secret. Why are the majority of dentists, public health officials, public health organizations, and a lot of people and organizations that citizens look up to,
yep,
why are so many of them, in North America at least, strongly pro fluoride?
Very simple. They only get one side of the story at dental school and possibly medical school. In dental school, only one side. They are brainwashed. Once they come out of dental school, they go into busy practices and they have no time to keep up with the literature. So the simple answer is they don't read. The second answer is peer pressure. This is almost a holy practice for the dental community. They've made their reputation as a servant of public health. Their contribution to medicine was made on the backs of the fluoridation research program. They're very proud of it. They believe in it. They just simply don't challenge themselves by reading the literature. And if they do step out of line, they get chastised. When doctors speak out, when dentists speak out, they get peer pressure. And sometimes they get fired. Sometimes they get brought before professional bodies. And I think Bob knows all about that.
We'll talk about the specific Calgary situation in a bit. But why do the people at the top, because medicine, it tends to be a hierarchical system, so if the people at the top say something, and if you get punished if you disagree with it, then that maintains, you know, pretty consistent viewpoints, except for a few heretics. Why are the people at the top so
enthusiastic? Well, I think I want to dwell on that point, because in a bureaucracy, it's not safe to challenge policy. Mm. You can't question policy. Your job in a bureaucracy is to carry out policy. Mm-hmm. So rightfully, policy is determined at the bottom.
And at the top.
At the top. Yes. And it's very, very difficult to change it from the bottom.
Right.
And you can't change it in the middle without people resigning, which is exactly what we need, by the way. We need a medical officer of health in Canada to resign because he is being forced to tell the public that fluoridation is safe and effective, when if he read a few pages, he would know that that was a lie, that he's deceiving the Canadian public. We need them to blow the whistle. There's not one medical officer of health that I'm aware of in Canada after 20 years of looking at this who in public has said that fluoridation is a bad idea. They, you know, you get along by going along, and they go along with this policy. When policy is king, science becomes a slave. And that's what you have here. Science has been jettisoned because these powerful people at the top, this is a program in which they believe. And they're more often than not political appointees. They're heads of Ministry of Health in Australia, in New Zealand, in England, in Ireland, and so on. These are political appointments. They are well paid. They don't want to lose those jobs. So they just do what the political hacks want.
In Canada, maybe a lot of people don't know this, dentistry is still largely a private service.
Yes.
Most people pay for their dental work.
Yeah.
In the United States, that's definitely true. It may be covered, some may be covered by insurance, but it's private money. There are some government dental programs, I think, for young children, for poor people or whatever, but the most people are paying for dental services. Whereas fluoridation is provided to everybody equally, regardless of your economic statuses. Is there this feeling that since dentists don't do anybody who doesn't walk in with a check in their hands, that fluoridation is the way it will give a benefit to everybody, the poor included.
I think individual dentists are pretty decent, and you'll find that many, many dentists volunteer in programs, and I don't see any evil intent on their part of promoting fluoridation. What we know is that 80% of dentists in the United States will not treat children on Medicaid. So whilst there are programs, the returns, the financial returns are so small, they're not interested, which is rather sad. And of course, it's sad because 80% of dental decay is actually in the 20% of low income children from low income families. So precisely the children that need help don't get it from organized dentistry. And the American Dental Association, which is more of a trade organization than a professional body, won't even allow, won't support the use of dental, not dentists, but professional dental therapists and so on to do basic things in remote areas of Alaska and so on. So it's pretty sad. But the perniciousness of the promotion of fluoridation is to say, we need fluoridation because we want to help poor children. Well, what hypocrisy if 80% of your dentists won't help poor children, even when there's a system to do it. And secondly, the last thing that children from low-income families need is a lowering of IQ. Mm-hmm. They've got so many strikes against them in terms of earning a living, surviving, etc., against inner city pollution and everything else.
Yeah, like the city of Flint. Yeah. I mean, it was known for a long time that lead reduced IQ.
Yeah.
And lead was in gasoline and lead was in paint. And after a century, they took that out. But we now have situations like Flint, Michigan, where lead's being leached out of the water pipes because of the water, which is mainly going to affect the IQ of poor children.
Yep.
And fluoride exacerbates that leaching of lead out of pipes and solder as well.
Ah, okay. So if you have lead pipes and fluoridated water, you're going to get more lead in the water. Let's turn to Calgary, because Calgary's had a very interesting kind of a love-hate relationship with fluoride,
you might say.
So, Bob, can you describe the comings and goings of water fluoridation in Calgary and how it was accomplished?
Well, water fluoridation, when it first came out in the 50s and 60s, was strongly opposed by medical officers of health, such as Dr. Hill. And he took a lot of flack for that during this time. But there was four plebiscites in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that actually defeated water fluoridation in Calgary, always by narrow margins. It was always hotly contested, a highly contentious topic, and polarized as it is today. And so those first four defeated fluoride. And then in 1989, there was quite a large influx of dollars from Alberta Health Services and Calgary Health Region. And they put out a lot of very convincing information, very glossy information and propaganda, I would say, to the general public. And so the plebiscite in 1989 narrowly passed water fluoridation. I think it was 53% to 47% at that time. And so then City Council approved water fluoridation. It took about 2 years to build the infrastructure. So in that would be 1991, fluoridation was first started in Calgary. And that was at one part per million. And then there was a large hue and cry and a backlash from the grassroots folks in Calgary, from the activists, and they actually took City of Calgary to court for putting this toxin in the water. That case was never resolved completely. But it did force the City of Calgary and the council to hold another referendum in 1998. Before they did that, they put together a so-called expert panel from the University of Calgary. And that expert panel, of course, was hand-chosen by the pro-fluoridationists. And so four of the five were very staunchly pro-fluoride before the panel. And one of them was neutral. And he was a statistician. So they came out with a non-consensual recommendation to City Council, and so it was 4-1 basically. And so the non-consensual person, his opinion was not really put forth. Mm-hmm. Their opinion was that water fluoridation was good and that it should be continued in Calgary water, but at 0.8 parts per million rather than 1 part per million. And so that was taken into account by City Council, and that was done. Actually, in 1998, I voted for water fluoridation because I hadn't studied the issue, and I looked at their information from the Alberta Health Services and the Calgary Health Region, and it looked good to me. I didn't have time to study everything that comes across my table as an MD, so I voted for it, and friends came to me afterwards and said, why did you vote for it? And so I said, looked at their literature, and they said, you should look at it yourself. So I took that on as a personal challenge, and I did so. And within a matter of weeks, I could see that we'd made a huge mistake here. It was just aghast, abhorrent what I found. And so I took it to my mentor, Dr. Jim Beck from the University of Calgary, who had taught me in medical school back in the 80s. And I said, Jim, would you mind having a look at this literature? And he said, sure, no problem. I'm retired now. And so he looked at it, and he came back a few weeks later and said exactly the same thing, that he was just astounded that we could be doing something like this to our citizens. And so his infamous words at that time were, Bob, with all this information against fluoridation, this was in 1999, we should have this gone in a few months. So him and I started the program of talking to the medical officers of health, the dental officers of health, the deans of the medical school, etc., counselors, city counselors often. It took us 12 years, with the help, of course, of the grassroots side, to actually have the fluoride taps turned off in Calgary. So in 2011, the city council put forth a motion. They had public consultations.
And but no plebiscite this time?
No plebiscite, no. They were relying on scientific information, and they were also looking at the morals and the ethicality of it all, or lack thereof, of mass medicating without control of dose or dosage and without follow-up and without informed consent. They actually signed that. It passed 10-3. It was 10-3 in 2011. Mayor Nenshi, who is pro-fluoride, was out of town, and Brian Pencott, another councillor, was anti-fluoride, was out of town. So the vote was 10-3 to remove fluoridation. And it happened within about a four-month time frame.
Okay, well, thanks for that history. And for those who don't know, Calgary is a city of well over a million people.
1.2 million.
Yeah. So fourth largest city in Canada, fourth or fifth largest city. After Florida was taken out, a study appeared that showed a rate of cavities in children in Calgary and Edmonton, sister city in Alberta to Calgary, showing or claiming to show that cavities went up after water fluoridation ceased in Calgary, but not Edmonton. So what do you say about that study?
Yeah, the infamous McLaren study from February of 2016, it's created quite a furor in Canada, and Calgary in particular. The study has been rebutted very strongly in the same journal that it was published in about a year later by seven very prominent PhDs, doctors, dentists, researchers. For one thing, there was about four times the amount of kids in Edmonton as there was in Calgary in the study. Calgary's kids' teeth were fluoridated when the study started in 2004, and then as I mentioned, we ended fluoridation in 2011, so for the last 3 years of the study, Calgary's kids were not fluoridated. And so what the press took out of that study and ran with hundreds of articles, and to this day they still say in every article that's produced, well, that study showed that Calgary's kids' teeth were a lot worse. And it does not show that. It shows that they ended up at exactly the same place when the study ended in 2014. And actually the rate of increase in Calgary's kids' teeth cavities slowed down after fluoridation. Most of the increase, there was
after
increase,
it was removed.
Yeah, there was increase in Edmonton's kids' teeth cavities and in Calgary's kids' cavities as well during that 10-year period. But in Calgary, which had a higher increase in cavities, most of that increase was before 2010. So it was while Calgary was fluoridated.
Now, there was another data point. There was a data point at the beginning and a data point at the end for Calgary and Edmonton. So basically four pieces of data, right? But there was a study in the middle. So what did that study
show?
I mean, the study in the middle of that wasn't really talked about.
Yes, that was not mentioned in the publication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the study that ended in 2009, and that showed again that Calgary's kids, almost all the increase in Calgary's kids' cavities occurred by that time.
So you're saying that the increase in cavities occurred before fluoridation was removed?
Exactly.
Which, if that data point had been added to that study, then that would have been pretty obvious.
It would have been very obvious. And of course, Dr. McLaren said, well, it wasn't exactly the same measurement and we had no control, as in we didn't have a sister city to compare to in that particular data set. So she used some excuses, some reasons to not include that. But I mean, you can very easily, you know, match those figures. And
my feeling is that any data point can be excluded if you really want to look for excuses.
If you really want to, yeah. But the primary endpoint showed that they were basically primary kids' teeth in Calgary were slightly worse, but not the stats were not significant there. And Edmonton's kids' teeth were slightly worse in permanent teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, it wasn't... the stats weren't significant there, but they ended up virtually the same level in 2014 when the study ended.
My last question, what's the economic motivation for fluoridation? I mean, is it just getting rid of toxic waste? Are there some other economic factors that are helping to propel this forward, to give this continuous momentum over
well,
the past 50 years?
That can be answered locally and internationally,
yeah.
Really, because in Calgary, in 2011, one of the pillars that we won the argument on, of course, there was the ethics and morality side, and there was the science side, but we also won it on economics, because it would have cost about $6 million to repair the infrastructure, which fluoride really attacks and beats up all infrastructure, mm-hmm. concrete, metal, everything. And so that would have had to be totally replaced for about $6 million. I think that figure probably stands today. It might be slightly higher than that, but it'd be around $6 million to refurbish the two plants in the north and the south of Calgary. And then about $1 million a year in product and training and such to refluoridate. So that's a fair chunk of change, even though mm-hmm. Calgary's budget's over $1 billion. It's still a fair chunk of money, mm-hmm. and where they're trying to cut taxes and trying to cut expenses and such. And of course, then the other side of it is primarily the fertilizer industry now that benefits millions, hundreds of millions of dollars now by, instead of disposing this toxic waste, as Paul described previously, in a proper disposal facility for toxic mm-hmm. waste, which would cost them, I've heard estimates anywhere between $1,000 and $6,000 a ton to dispose. Instead, they can sell it back to us at about $1,000 a ton. So it's a big win for industry in the southern states, the fertilizer industry. And now we're getting a lot of it from China. And so they're quite happy to sell us their toxic waste to put in our water as well.
David, there are many economic interests which thread in and out of this mm-hmm. issue. Chris Bryson, former BBC producer, spent 10 years writing a book called The Fluoride Deception.
An excellent book.
It's a wonderful book. And he outlines the evidence, very, very clear evidence, that there was collusion between the US Public Health Service and the Fluorine Lawyers Association. The Fluorine Lawyers Association, representing industries that were polluting the environment mm-hmm. with fluoride and maybe endangering the health of their own workers. That was one economic interest, industry interest. Another one, 1 year before the US Public Health Service mysteriously endorsed fluoridation, before any trial had been completed, the sugar lobby, representing 130 sugar interests, the Sugar Research Foundation, said we need to find a way to reduce tooth decay without reducing sugar consumption. And they have been in this business for years and years and years. The sugar lobby has used and loves to use a promotion of fluoridation as a way of distracting from the overconsumption of sugar.
So we can sell you something that's really bad for your teeth, but yes. You put something in the water to...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
marvelous distraction. Then, of course, you've got all the interest of the pharmaceutical industry and the manufacturers of fluoridated toothpaste,
Colgate, Johnson & Johnson.
All those people have an interest and worry about liabilities if water fluoridation falls They're going to be worried when we start talking about the health effects, big liabilities. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of economic interest involved here. Plus the fact that, you know, going back to dentists, many dentists who haven't read the literature are truly proud of the fluoridation. It's a belief system, and it's the reputation, it's pride, it's reputation, it's ego. Dentistry made its, it got its status, essentially, from water fluoridation. Water fluoridation was a research program based upon which the National Institute of Dental Research came into existence. That institute, in 1948, two years before the endorsement by the US. So they were able to take dentistry from a sort of plumbing exercise of fixing people's teeth to becoming a part of medicine and attracting the same kind of big dollars for dental research that other. So you can see built into this is a huge pride in water fluoridation, and it will be a major blow to the institution to lose it. The dental lobby does not want to lose this. So whatever economic aspects are, there is this human aspect of pride and not wanting
the status more than anything else.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, I know that people listening to this are concerned about many, many issues. And like me, they don't want another problem. I would urge them, just help us with this problem, because of all the problems out there, this is the easiest one to fix. Mm-hmm. All you've got to do is to turn off a tap at the waterworks. Turn off the spigot at the waterworks, and it's over. It's the easiest issue to solve once we have the political will. But we can only get the political will if we have masses of people concerned. So that's what your program is doing. It's increasing, I hope, the number of people that are concerned, that can put the pressure on the political centers to say, stop this foolish practice, regain the public's trust, come clean, regain the public's trust. And part of our problem is the major media are not doing service, so they're not being professional about this issue.
Well, thank you for joining me today, gentlemen. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you for doing this, David.
Yeah, thank you, David. Thank you. You're so important. I can't stress enough. And whether you have this on air or not, and I'm not buttering you up because the thing is over now. I'm saying is, with the decline of the mainstream media, with the lack of serious, fewer and fewer serious investigative journalists out there, we need media like your own to get the truth out, to get this discourse on this kind of topic. It's forbidding for many people. You're doing a great job, you know, making this available to public. We are relying on you.
Thank you for listening to episode 222 of The Infectious Myth. Until next week, goodbye.